How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. If you're a regular listener, you'll know I'm all about building your brain, your body, and your business. Today, we're focused on the body. I have one of the world's leading experts in increasing your health span, your lifespan, and also your soul span. I have longevity cardiologist, Dr. Paddy Barrett. The information you're about to get in this episode is phenomenal. This will teach you the essentials of how to live longer and maybe even live past 100. Here's my chat with Paddy. Paddy, welcome to the pod.
Good to be here.
I was commenting on your very slick and crisp setup.
Well, it's not my first rodeo doing this stuff. So I have other skills, nunchuck skills included, but you know.
We'll start with a little formal introduction. What's your role and what do you do?
I am a preventive cardiologist. So I'm the cardiologist you want to see years before you have a heart attack rather than before you have one.
Preventative. I love that word. That's kind of been my focus for the last 5 years. And that's kind of how I stumbled across your content. How I stumbled across you was about 6 or 9 months ago on Twitter. You just kept appearing. And it's rare because I'm always looking for Irish people to follow. And it's very, very rare that someone in your space pops up. So you've a big following on Twitter, 50K plus. Like, how did that come about?
Well, I had joined Twitter, well over a decade ago. And so, you know, I had a reasonably big following in terms of like a small thousand, 10 years ago. This was kind of part of my time in California. I was training in a medical institute there, and there was a big focus on both digital technologies and also kind of the technologies that integrate them, social media, etc. So my mentor at the time, a guy called Dr. Eric Topol, is a huge advocate of Twitter. We all kind of followed suit in that sense. And then it became very quickly apparent that in terms of keeping up with medical science, it was probably one of the best ways of doing so. And also seeing the conversations between really legends in the field who were debating and discussing different ideas at the time. So it was just an unparalleled opportunity. And then on the back of that, I just started to, rather than be a consumer of content, be a producer of content. And in general, it just takes time as you kind of do so and you play that game. It ultimately builds into a kind of a larger audience over time.
It's interesting that I think I'll always call it Twitter, by the way. X, if you're being pedantic, but Twitter, I think I'll always call it Twitter for all time. So it was interesting. You were in California, so that's kind of where your first kind of like thoughts were about personal branding, because I speak about personal branding on this podcast a lot, because I believe so many founders are missing a trick. They're missing that, not trick, but they're missing the point of building your own personal brand. So was that a conscious thing for you to do?
Not necessarily at the start. It was very much around reach of message. As we were kind of talking about before we started the podcast here, I had a podcast back in 2015, 2016. And in looking at actually getting your message out and the scientific writing that I had been doing, and you looked at the reach of that compared to having, say, a podcast at the time, it was night and day. So the podcast at the time would have had about 1 million downloads. And so in terms of reach, using the tools that were really only becoming available at the time, setting up kind of podcasts, social media for publication of kind of information and spreading of content, really kind of presenting your message, there was no comparison. And so in my view, you were either on this wave of presenting content out to the world, or you weren't capitalizing on probably one of the greatest opportunities anyone who has a message to share with the world, could have. So, that's where it came from for me. It was about if your business is sharing ideas, and telling a story, these vehicles that we have in terms of social media and the different media platforms are just a phenomenal opportunity. And I just used it. And on the back of that, you develop a personal brand.
I think when you see the likes of Peter Attia, Andrew Huberman, I think if we had that discussion like 10 years ago going, oh, some of the biggest people in the world on social media will be like, a preventive medicine specialist and a doctor from Harvard. It'd be wild. You wouldn't believe it. But I think that's the power of the medium, right?
Yeah. And I mean, historically, if you wanted to have a big reach in medicine, for example, you you ran large clinical trials. You published those in very large peer-reviewed famous journals, and your message was spread to the world. And that was an excellent way to do things. But when the medium changed and you had the opportunity to change the cycle at which you could get out information, rather than going through, 2 to 5 years of raising money for a trial, doing all the investigation, getting it accepted in a journal, getting it published, the difference was you could just get on a social media platform or a media platform like YouTube or Twitter or a podcast platform, and you could have a conversation about that topic and it could go out that day. And you could, the reps that you could do would just produce such volume and reach. So it doesn't take away from the traditional methods of how we get a message across, i.e. doing scientific research. That's still the cornerstone of where the discussion comes from. That's necessary. It's the layers on top of that. We still need to have people who will write the deep expertise of books that we will have to be able to consume over time. But we also need the commentary on those central pieces of information, seen as experts having commentary. And that's where everyone has an opportunity to be part of the conversation here. You don't have to be, writing the book, and you don't have to be doing the clinical trial. But if you have an interesting perspective on core pieces of information in your content, you can be a very, very valuable voice in that community.
Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish business who grew from one idea to become world-class companies able to compete with the very best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to becoming more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. And if there's one thing that entrepreneurs want, aside from more money, it's more time. The local enterprise offices want to give that back. Their supports for competitiveness and productivity can help your business save time, money, and energy. For them, it's all in a day's work. So if you want to give your business the gift of time, decreased costs, and lower electricity bills, then go to allinadayswork.ie, take 2 minutes to fill out the form, and let your local enterprise office handle the rest. If you've been listening for a while, you know Iconic Offices have been my partner for ages now. Working and recording out of their flexible workspaces has meant a huge deal to the success of this podcast. So it made perfect sense to partner up with them again for season 17, but to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, a unique offer. Come work in the Iconic Office workspaces for free with no catches. Simply visit the link in the description below and enter Gary24 for a free day pass or a free day office pass. Enjoy. Why do you think so many people are resistant to building their own personal brand? Because I still see it with a lot of founders here in Ireland and abroad that they kind of almost hide behind the company. Maybe it's different in your field, but why do you think so many people are resistant to put themselves out there?
I think there's a lot of reasons. The first one is I think people don't really see the value in it up front. They don't realize that the reach is there and the opportunities that can come from it. I think a lot of people will just see going on social media as being a lightning rod for, criticism or adverse commentary, etc. But the problem is that I think as humans, we're not designed to actually communicate in the way that social media platforms allow us to. In terms of, I have, 50,000 followers on Twitter, and, I will write a tweet or a thread and it will be, get high engagement and it'll be seen by a couple of 100,000 people. But we're not designed as humans to say, stand up in front of Crow Park or a large stadium and say, I'm going to say X. And now I want you all individually to give me your response in terms of what you think of that. We're not designed to work that way. So you really have to get your head in a position whereby you're saying, listen, here is my message. I'm going to put it out there. If you find this valuable or interesting, great. If you want to have a positive kind of interaction or dialogue, great. But you have to remember that is the type of a communication platform that you are on. You have to look at it like a tool. You can't take in all the commentary that comes back to you in that format, just like you wouldn't stand on a stadium, in a large stadium and receive the feedback from every single person there.
It's a good way of looking at it, actually. How do you deal with the negativity or kind of the hate you might get on social media?
really simply, I realized that my front of house in terms of what I do is very much on point and around the niche of cardiovascular health. And so I'm talking, so I don't talk about really anything else outside of that, which I believe is part of my professional identity. My opinions on this are based on objective data or my kind of often kind of slant on it. And people are free to read that information and find value in it. But if you don't find value in it and you want to, comment on something I say that I think is more of an ad hominem attack, it's very simple. I either just entirely ignore it, or more often than not, I will simply mute the person on Twitter, and specifically mute them and not block them. The reason is that if I block someone, they know that I have blocked them, and therefore they know that they've tweaked me in terms of irritated me to actually take an action. Whereas if I mute them, they're just speaking into the ether and I never hear anything that they have to say. I rarely read most of the comments. I see it as a public announcement platform. It is not for dialogue, just the same way as I said about the standing in front of a stadium. As humans, we're not designed to communicate that way. I much prefer the famous line from Hot Tub Time Machine that, back in the 80s, people used to talk to each other with their faces. I think that's how we communicate in terms of dialogue. But the key is to realize, I think people have a lot of misunderstandings around Twitter. People, for example, think that, it's the standing in front of the stadium. When in fact, Twitter, you have to look at it, it's a bit like the Colosseum. There are gladiators and then there is the crowd. And so the people who are going to be the producers of content are the gladiators. And the crowd, it vastly outweighs the gladiators. And they go to watch the gladiators fight. And so you have to realize that you're either one of the gladiators or you are a spectator. And sometimes the spectator heckles the gladiator. A lot of the time people, ask for support from their supporters. But if you realize that you can be a gladiator and you don't have to fight, but you can still get in front of the crowd, you win on both sides. The problem is when you are the gladiator and the crowd starts to boo you, for example, people get upset and frustrated. And again, we're not designed as humans to receive the displeasure from hundreds of thousands of people. It's all about how you frame the message. I put the message out there. If you want to read it, if you find value, that's fantastic. If you don't find value, that's fine. Go read something else. You're under no obligation to read my content, and I'm under no obligation to read your response. I just simply look at it that way. So that makes my life a lot easier.
A couple of epic references there. Hot Tub Time Machine and gladiators. We are off to a strong start. I like that. I said this to a friend of mine yesterday. He was having an issue with someone, and I was like, look, all bullies want is a reaction. They just want to see that they've got to you. I was like, the number one thing, their weak spot is attention. If you just take that away, if you just silence anything to them, it kills them. I like that. It's a very healthy approach. Talk to me about your kind of preventative medicine, right? This is kind of the key area I wanted to talk to you about, because I think in Ireland, maybe globally, you can kind of enlighten me more on this. We very much focus on the problem. You go to the doctor when there's a problem. I get my bloods done twice a year, preventative, right? And when I say it to people, they're like, why'd you go to the doctor? I was like, to get my bloods done, to find out what might go wrong. And they're like, why would you do that? There's really a kind of like, I go to the doctor when I'm sick mentality. Is that an Irish approach or is that global?
That's a global problem. And that's a reflection of just the way that healthcare is set up in general. And that's not a criticism of healthcare. I think if you look historically, 100 years ago, doctors, for the most part, were doing things that were probably barbaric and of no help to anyone. The only people who probably were doing some value, were surgeons who were lancing boils and opening abscesses. And they actually got disbarred from being doctors. And that's why they're called Mr. in the Irish and UK setup. But the doctors who were treating patients with medicines were probably doing tremendous harm. And then we fast forward, through the evolution of science and how we go through the kind of the scientific revolution. And we arrive at a system which is actually incredible at treating diseases. So the role of the doctor is to meet someone when they have a problem, typically defined by a disease, and be adept at actually treating that, diagnosing it, and providing the infrastructure of support around it. So historically, and in an amazingly effective way, you know, medicine has been a reactionary system to the presentation of illness. What we've learned over time is that those illnesses are very much predictable on an odds basis based on certain inputs. So therefore, if you change the inputs, you can change the odds of the output. And people have recognized this and are starting to kind of apply this in a much more focused way in terms of their individual health. But they're trying to do it within a healthcare system that is really just a set up to deal with diseases predominantly, not always, but predominantly, and is also B, totally overwhelmed with the tsunami of chronic diseases that currently exist. So the opportunity for you to be able to execute on that plan within the current infrastructure is just not optimal. And that creates a number of problems. One is that people know that this opportunity exists. And so they go to find solutions elsewhere outside of really structured medical environments. And they find recommendations from people who maybe don't have the same level of integrity or scientific training.
To be very diplomatically put,
mild about it. And so therefore, you know, people end up with like loads of crazy recommendations about how to approach things. And so this is the kind of the dilemma that we find ourselves. And medicine is slowly building out, I think, platforms for people to take that approach in terms of look at this on purely an odds basis and say, listen, what's the most likely condition that's going to kill me? Is there elements of risk that I can identify up front? Can I pull levers of risk reduction hard early so that I can actually de-risk that kind of probability to increase the probability that I will live longer without a major chronic disease and live at a higher quality of life, both from a physical function point of view, a cognitive function point of view, and then look at that long life with those health span features in place and ask yourself fundamentally, what are you going to do with that time? And so I think people for years have been trying to kind of pull together all the different strands of how that works, but we're slowly seeing, I think, opportunities for that to be packaged together in a much more structured healthcare environment, delivered in a scientifically valid way. And, you know, hopefully we see that crystallize into much more kind of structured products.
Yeah. And I think that's why your content resonated with me so much. I said this to you before we got started that, you know, over the last kind of like 5 years of doing this podcast, I've really shifted my focus to body first, brain, then body, then business, and trying to like bring that knowledge to founders. So that's why I was so excited to get you on today, because I think there is a personally lack of, as you said, quality, medically proven knowledge. There's a lot of info. The world is full of info about like what you should be doing and what latest bad is. So I was very excited to get you on from like a medical perspective to talk about the big things, like what should founders be doing? So let's dig into it straight away. You mentioned a couple of like key risk factors there, and key diseases that can kill people. And I think that's why I love the quality of your writing as well. It's so accessible. Like you present ideas in a very clear and actionable way. So kind of talk to me about the key risk factors first people should be thinking about.
Well, again, I think from a risk factor perspective, you're getting into the tactical approaches in terms of how you're managing risk. And I think you always need to take a step back and ask really what your goal is in terms of what you're trying to do. So, you know, if your goal is to be a Hunter S. Thompson character sitting at home, you know, drinking chartreuse in a hot tub, you know, till 3 o'clock in the morning, doing lines of cocaine and, you know, doing whatever else, if that's your goal, you know, knock yourself out. So first you have to say, listen, what are you really trying to achieve? And more importantly, why? Now, so because I'm not here to tell people what to do. I'm here to help people hit their goals that they believe are the highest representations for themselves. So we always have to step back. So it's not that everyone needs to be doing X type of training with a specific lactate threshold and a specific ApoB concentration below the X percentile. No. Ask yourself, what is my goal? And then you're looking for me is I look at health through the optimization of three main variables. One is lifespan. how long you will live. Two is health span, the quality of kind of your cognition and your movement in the world. And third is soul span. And soul span is the idea of, are you actually actualizing yourself in the world? Are you becoming the best version that is the highest representation of your truest values? Because the only reason that you want to live longer and with a higher quality of life is that you can use that time to be the best version of yourself. And that becomes your why. That becomes the motivation that you will take on the hard challenges of doing the things that will make you live longer and hopefully delay the onset of major chronic diseases. And it is only when you've answered those questions appropriately will you be able to move forward and address this question. And so it is understandable that people want to go straight to the tactical information of, you know, your blood pressure is a number one risk factor for death globally worldwide. What should your blood pressure be? And it's really important that the people get that right if longevity is of interest. But step back first and ask yourself why you want to do this in the first place. Because this provides the framework and the motivation for doing it. So that's how I do it, rather than kind of jumping into the tactical things first. But if you want kind of the optimization around, I want to live longer with a higher quality of life, and it's, you know, I want to be around so that I can play with my children and grandchildren and do all those things, you have to look at this on an actuarial math basis. This is not about kind of like putting your finger in the air and having a kind of, you know, well, you know, people can choke from pens, so I should get rid of all the pen caps in my house. And it's like, yeah, technically you could die swallowing your pen, you know, but like on a probabilistic basis, that's highly unlikely. So you have to look at mortality data and you have to say, listen, what do most adults die from in the developed world? And they die from cardiovascular disease, cancer, and dementia. And that's predominantly looking at people who are non-smokers, because I think if you're a smoker, you're not really interested in preventing diseases, because as Carl Jung says, show me what you do, you are what you do, not what you say. So, you know, if you're still smoking, you're really not interested in that. So kind of, you don't have to prove it to me. So cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia. And then we look at our ideal phenotype in terms of who is the person we're trying to emulate. And that person we're trying to emulate is the healthy centenarian, the person who lives to 100 years of age, you know, is has no major chronic medical conditions, is able to do many of the things that you would hope to do at that age. They're not perfect, and has their cognition intact, and maybe has spent a life doing something that is purposeful and meaningful. So then we ask ourselves, how do they get there? And the real answer with them is that it's probably, in terms of those later years, is probably genetics. So then you have to say, well, okay, well, how can we look at what they die from as a model? And they die from one of three things, generally: cardiovascular disease, cancer, and dementia. So they die from the same things as everybody else. The key difference is they get those conditions 20 to 25 years later than everybody else. So the goal here is not to prevent the onset of cardiovascular disease, cancers, and dementias forever. It's about to delay them ideally 10 to 20 years. You know, maybe we won't live to 110 years of age, but maybe if we apply the same model, maybe we can live an additional 10 years. So maybe that means not dying at 75, it's dying at 85, or 85 instead of, you know, 95. And then you say, well, okay, so if the key here is to, you know, not get the condition, that you know, you can't die from a condition that you don't have in simple terms. So you have to then say, well, listen, what are the risk factors that actually increase the probability of an early diagnosis of one of these medical conditions, of which we're focused on cardiovascular disease being the number one driver? And then you can say, okay, here's my objective. If risk factors can be modified, and then you actually look at, when you modify risk factors, does it delay the onset of these major conditions? And the answer is yes, it does. So that has to be your kind of strategic framework for how you're applying this this model. And if you don't understand that first, you're going to flail around just looking at numbers and not understanding why you're doing what you're doing. And that's where the emphasis then becomes the very aggressive management of risk factors for disease. And we can talk a little bit about those in terms of what they are, but it's really important that you get the model right first.
What an answer. That was phenomenal. And I love that. I love that. It's not like about, oh, just go do this for this many minutes per week. It's a very holistic. And like, I love that, the soul span, because health span, lifespan, we're all familiar with, you know, lifespan, right? I think everyone gets it. Health span has kind of become kind of into the public consciousness in the last 10 years. It's not about living longer, it's about living better. And then soul span, I love that. Having your purpose, like, why are you living longer? What's that reason? I think that really resonates. So thank you very much for sharing that. So the three biggest things: cardiovascular, cancer, and then dementia. You talk then about, you know, aggressively going after it. So what are the aggressive steps you normally take?
So then you're in this dilemma where you have to look at what's the difference between average and optimal. So, you know, most adults should be active. What does that mean, though, in terms of activity? If you look at the way I look at it is you have your prevention pyramid in terms of the four fundamental pillars will be around your exercise, nutrition, sleep, and stress. This is a lifestyle approach first. I would argue that sleep and stress have to be at the bottom of that pyramid in terms of, because if you don't have sleep and stress right, the opportunity to have nutrition and exercise right is incredibly poor. So you then kind of look at these four parameters and you say, am I optimizing those as best as I can to achieve the goal that I'm looking to do? And so when we talk about nutrition, for example, to start, it's one of my least favorite topics to talk about because it is so mired in controversy and it doesn't have to be. The fundamental issue with nutrition, outside of, you know, maintaining obviously kind of appropriate minerals and vitamins, etc., is your nutrition leading you to have excess visceral fat, the fat inside your abdominal cavity, to become a driver of insulin resistance, which is the precursor for diabetes? And so therefore, you use nutrition as that lever to actually control that as one of the biggest controllers. And so that is, nutrition is a phenomenal tool to actually modify that. Because if you have insulin resistance, it is one of the biggest amplifiers of risk for cardiovascular disease, many cancers, and also many types of dementia. And so this becomes one of the big key frameworks that we're looking at. You're always saying, where am I on that insulin sensitivity to insulin resistance continuum? Knowing that you can move very freely up and down it in both directions. And it is largely driven by excess visceral fat in your abdominal cavity. And that threshold for the amount of visceral fat is unique to everyone. There is obviously very kind of reasonable boundaries, but some people just require a small amount of excess, fat to actually have excess visceral fat. And some people require much more. And this is what's called the personal fat threshold. So that's the kind of the first one in terms of using nutrition to do that. The second thing is going to be exercise. And exercise, you know, in terms of if you're saying, well, most people should go for a walk and get, you know, 7,000 or 8,000 steps per day. But you have to say, well, where are the upper limits in that in terms of our kind of boundaries of benefit? And we know that people, so again, you can't go on subjective, well, I go for a walk or I do exercise on a regular basis. You have to be very strict about how you define things and an objective input. So you say, well, we're going to look at fitness basically is made up of three components. It is made up of your aerobic performance, and that is VO2 max. Your metabolic flexibility, the quickness that how efficiently that you can turn fat into fuel. And thirdly, the performance metrics of muscle mass, muscle strength, and muscle power. And so that is when we're talking about exercise, you're saying, how can I optimize and train for all of these three core metrics? And how can I objectively quantify how I'm performing in those? Am I at average? Or am I above average? And if your aspiration is to be above average as an 80-year-old or 90-year-old, and the idea of, you know, being a kind of an average 80-year-old kind of unsettles you, if you want to be an above average 80-year-old or 90-year-old, you have to be an above average 50-year-old. It doesn't work if you actually, you know, it's not like, well, I'll do this for now and then I'll become above average later. No, you're already losing ground now. So you need to build in that headroom. And so that is aerobic training in terms of metabolic flexibility, that's zone training to build out that aerobic base. And then on top of that, it will increase your VO2 max, of which you layer on interval training. And then you're going to do resistance training for building muscle mass and power, and also strength and flexibility will be other things. So you have to be very structured about how you go at this. Don't get me wrong. If your objective is to, you know, from an exercise perspective, I just want to go outside. I want to go for a run. I just want to put in my headphones and listen to some music. And it's just good for my soul when I do that. Go and do that. However, if you're using exercise as a tool to hit a specific goal, be very precise about how you do it. This is, again, what is your goal? What are you trying to do here? Are you just trying to, you know, let off some steam after a kind of a rough day in the office? Or are you optimizing for a variable? That's how you approach it.
Superb. I love that deliberate. I've kind of a phrase in my head I keep there all the time, like live a deliberate life. That's kind of how I approach most things. Don't float, live a deliberate life.
Well, Charles Bukowski will say, and I'm going to just paraphrase this, you know, you have to decide what you're going to do with yourself, or else the world will decide for you, and you won't be happy when it decides for you. We are incentive-based creatures. As Charlie Munger says, he says, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome.
It's one of my favorite quotes of all time. Yeah,
if you don't get very clear in terms of what your goals are, in terms of what you're trying to do, the goals and processes and pathways will be imposed upon you. And this becomes, you know, this sounds, well, that's all very good for you to say. And that the bottom line is that if you look at people who are at the end of their life, who are there dying on their deathbeds, and you ask them, and the research has been done on this, so it's quite clear, this isn't just my kind of personal observations, but I've seen it personally as well. You ask them, what is it that you actually regret at the end of their life? And consistently, the top two things that people will say, number two, I worked too hard. And I didn't take enough time. The only people that will remember that you stayed late at work are your kids. Number one, in terms of the thing that people actually regret the most, is that they did not have the courage to live the life that they knew that they truly should have. And so this is the problem, that if you don't get deliberate about it, you are going to be incentivized to do everything that does not align with what your personal preferences are in terms of your personal the best value representation and the highest order representation of who you are. So unless you are absolutely crystal clear about that, the probability of you stumbling upon that target accidentally is virtually zero.
Really quick break to thank today's sponsor. If you've been inspired by listening to The Amazing Business Person and either want to start your own business or supercharge an existing one, then the Local Enterprise Office has something for you. Whether you want to improve your online presence, become more sustainable, get into new markets, or just get the idea off the ground, they have the support for you. For more information, check out your local enterprise office on localenterprise.ie and see how they can help your business today. Now, back to the episode. And I love this because I think there's a lot of people who kind of almost view, you know, looking after yourself as selfish, as like, you know, I'll just put everybody else first. And entrepreneurs are very guilty of falling into that trap of like putting the business first, when in reality, all you're doing is robbing the business from you, either in the future performance or your performance right now. Like you're just, and it's the same with your kids. Like if you're just putting everybody else first now, all you're doing is robbing years from them. I think that's why I loved your concept so much of the 10 extra years, because you're just stealing that from them in the future. You know, you're really just taking, you're borrowing from the future. You're borrowing from the bank of the future. Talk to me about stress, because the founders listening will be like, okay, yeah, I get it. They're very logical creatures. They're very much probably tuned into a lot of what you're saying. And I love to see so many founders now getting massively into their fitness. But a lot of them struggle on the stress aspect. Talk to me about that.
So first, you have to understand what stress is. Stress is not the adversity that you face in life. Stress is your maladaptive response to the adversity that you face in life. Stress is the maladaptive response to your expectations of your life. Stress is not the adversity. The flood will always come. It is how you respond cognitively to that load that actually determines stress. So the simple answer is, you know, it becomes irritating, for example, when you hear a car alarm going off outside. The car alarm intrinsically is not annoying. It is your response to the car alarm that makes you irritated. So always remember, this is the idea of mind the gap. There's a gap between what your thoughts are and what your emotional response is to it. And for most people, they are very, very tightly connected. So always understand, though, that your thoughts do not have to translate into emotions. As Mark Twain famously said, I've suffered a great many tragedies in my life, most of which have never happened. And so most of the stress that people actually experience in life is not a stress based on objective, real problems. Of course, that happens to people. Bad things happen, tragedies occur, people die, awful things happen in life. They are absolutely soul-destroying, awful moments in your life. And that, you know, it's very hard to say, well, I'm just going to be balanced about it and not respond emotionally. No one is saying that you should try to do that. Where most of the stress comes from in life is the anticipation of something that might happen, or your rumination about something that you said or did. So most of your stress is a self-imposed narrative on an expectation typically of the future of something that may or may not happen. So you are suffering twice. And as the line goes, pain is mandatory, or is, you know, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And so the pain will always happen. The question is how much are you going to suffer? And this is a tool that we can all train. And it's not to say that you will never suffer ever again in terms of as you approach this, but you have to, you can deploy skills that can dampen the amplitude of that distress and suffering. You can dampen the duration of how long it happens for. And that is a learned skill that you can actually develop. So I personally believe that if you look at someone's cognitive well-being in terms of their freedom from the maladaptive impacts of stress, is if you have that as a chronic issue, it will be an acute issue for time to time for everyone. But if you have that as a chronic issue, the probability of you being able to make the appropriate decisions in life for you to be able to hit the goals that you want to hit is very low. So first and foremost, you have to protect your mind. Because if you don't protect that, the probability of you being able to perform appropriately across every other domain has been obliterated. So that's the kind of my general kind of spiel on stress.
Good spiel. In fairness, it's very logical. There's definitely a lot of stoicism in you. You definitely have a lot of stoic characteristics. How do you advise your clients then to deal with stress? Because you said it's the response, and you said that's a skill that can be developed. What do you advise them to do?
So this is, I think it depends on the magnitude of the problem. The reality is, for some people, it's a very chronic, debilitating problem, and they need professional support in terms of looking at cognitive behavioral therapy or different strategies to actually approach that problem. If they are finding it very hard to integrate back into kind of normal environments, or it's really seriously impacting their ability to operate at work, there are structured approaches, largely things like CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, that can provide you a set of skills that can do that. But in addition to that, the thing that certainly for me that has worked personally is this idea of the difference between thoughts and emotions and the gap that exists between them. And this is really where the true power of something like meditation comes from. Meditation is training your mind's strength in its ability to recognize thoughts that simply appear for whatever reason and to not let them suddenly become destructive emotions. And so it is your ability to non-judgmentally observe your thoughts. People think that meditation is about clearing your mind from thoughts and you're going to sit there in some nirvana state of bliss. It's like nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is that it gives you that opportunity to stretch that gap between thought and emotion just enough that you can recognize it for what it is and not let it bear down on you with the emotional valence that it typically does. And so that is the superpower. That is the ability to stay calm in the eye of the storm. And so that is a practiced skill that anyone can develop. And it seems trendy to talk about kind of meditation because it's like it's up there with like green juices and kind of acai bowls.
Don't forget cold plunging. Yeah. It's up there cold plunging.
Yeah. Well. So like the bottom line is when something has been around for thousands of years, there is value in them there hills. And you should recognize it for what it is. And people will say, well, if I do meditation, I might lose my edge as a type A individual. Horseshit. You just become a more powerful version of the person that you truly are. You become the person who can hold composure when everyone else around you is losing theirs. You become the person who can be laser focused on what it is that you want and what you want to do, and not be perturbed by the sea of emotions that are surrounding you. That is the real skill. So it is for me one of the foundational skills. And that is just the same as that you do exercise to improve your metabolic performance and increase the number of mitochondria and their efficiency. You lift weights to increase your muscle mass and muscle size. You have to do the reps cognitively to build that skill if that is something that you want.
Mental fitness, you know, it's literally training your mind. We talk about mental health a lot, as if it's something that happens to you, but the mental fitness, training your mind, is like you said, like you wouldn't just go, I'm going to have a crack at a marathon and then not train at all for it. You would literally train slowly, slowly, slowly. So I love that. And thank you for giving us a kind of a practical takeaway, because I think I love when people are listening going, look, I'm identifying with a lot of what Paddy says. So it's lovely to get kind of practical takeaways that people can take. So you've given us some really good ones there in terms of fitness, but also the mental fitness side of things. Talk to me then about the longevity side of things, in terms of like living, you said living to like 90 to 100, the blue zone idea, is that real or is that clever marketing?
I think it's such a lovely idea that sitting around with friends drinking red wine would be the thing that would mean that you would live to 110 years of age. It's such a lovely idea, except that it doesn't hold up in reality when you investigate it in terms of the science. The literature around this, I mean, if you just think it from just a first principles point of view, you know, the classic examples of the blue zones, and then you say it's typically this small town in the Mediterranean where people, you know, walk around and they spend time with family and they have faith and they, you know, they have dinner with their loved ones and they drink some red wine and they eat mostly vegetables. And you go, yeah, they're all really sensible things to do, like truly really sensible things to do, with the exception maybe of the red wine. The reality is that pattern of life exists across so many different types of small villages around the world. Yet, for some strange reason, we do not see that signal of people consistently living to beyond 110 years of age. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why is that? Is there something in the water? Is there something unique? And when you actually look at the other factors that actually link up most of the blue zones, you'll find that it's poverty, illiteracy, high rates of smoking, remote areas from actually registration of birth and death, and very poor record keeping. And so when you actually look at the adoption of census records and mandatory birth registrations across the different states in the United States, the rates of super centenarians, i.e. those people who live beyond 110 years of age, drops immediately off a cliff the minute you introduce mandatory registration. If you are a super centenarian in the United States, you are 1.5 times more likely to be born on the first of the month. If you are a super centenarian in Japan, you are 2.7 times more likely to be born on the first of the month. So quite frankly, I think that blue zones, the commonalities that exist to them, are really great foundational approaches to improving your health in general. And if you were to apply them properly, you probably will live another, you know, several years, maybe 10 years extra, but it's not going to make you live till 110. And the reasons that those blue zones exist are likely artifacts of record keeping rather than lifestyle.
A lot of bubbles have just burst right across the Mediterranean. That's fascinating. That's a really good insight. There's a lot of the footballers in Italy at the minute. They're like, yeah, turns out he's actually 10 years older than we thought he was when we bought him. There's a couple of court cases rumbling on at the minute. That's really interesting. Talk to me about, you mentioned red wine there. Talk to me about alcohol and the impact that has on your performance.
So we need to be very careful about the metric that we're looking at in terms of harm or benefit. You said performance. And so most of the literature is based around chronic medical conditions and longevity. There was literature historically saying that drinking 1 to 2 drinks of alcohol per day actually offered a protective advantage in terms of mortality or freedom from certain diseases. That has likely been an artifact of what's called a healthy user bias. So the person who's only drinking 1 or 2 glasses of red wine a day is likely to be doing other things like not smoking and being kind of fit and healthy and all those things. And so these are what are called confounders in observational epidemiology. When you, as best as possible, correct for these, you will find that the true relationship exists on a linear basis, that for every additional unit of alcohol you consume, regardless of what type of alcohol, the risk of major chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, cancers, etc., goes up. Now, let's be clear. There's a dose effect here. As Paracelsus says, the dose that make it the poison. If you're drinking an awful lot, the risk goes up an awful lot. If you're drinking a little amount, the risk goes up very marginally. And I say this as someone who drinks alcohol a lot less than I used to, but I still drink alcohol. And so from a disease perspective, from a kind of a medical health perspective, there is no amount of alcohol that is good for you. It is likely that large amounts of alcohol are very bad for you, But it is also true that very small amounts of alcohol are unlikely to be very, very harmful to you. There's lots of things that we do that are potentially harmful. Every time you get in your car, you take a massive risk, probably way more than drinking small amounts of alcohol, as long as you're not doing them together. And so we need to see things in context. Now, you also have to look at then in terms of performance. One of the primary reasons that I do not drink alcohol kind of to any significant degree anymore is its impact on my sleep. I hold sleep in terms of as much as possible, sacrosanct as possible. And I say this as the father of a 3-month-old and a 3-year-old. So, you know, it's not that I am some solo person here on my own trying to optimize my best life. I have, you know, as Tommy Tiernan would say, two children and an adult in the house. But I find that if I drink over 2 drinks, my sleep quality falls to pieces, and I'll wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'll be staring at the ceiling because of my deep sleep is just absolutely whacked. And we know this in terms of alcohol will significantly impact your sleep architecture. So that's the main reason. Now, I still drink alcohol, just not a lot. I still really enjoy kind of a whiskey-based cocktail before dinner or a really nice glass of red wine. So when I make this commentary, it's not from some puritanical position that there is a moral valence to my commentary. It is purely based on the literature and my own personal experience of what I'm trying to optimize for.
I think that's a great answer because everyone's looking for the rule, right? Everyone wants the one rule. Or just tell us the one rule, Paddy. Tell us the one rule for nutrition, the one rule for working out, the one rule for alcohol. And it's just so interesting there about the context. Context is everything, right? And it has to be personal. Like what? And you're very specific about how you answer the question. You said performance, that, and then this. I think, you know, context is so important, and it has to be why. What's your why? Why do you want to drink? Why do you not want to drink? There's so many contexts, but like people love to take like extreme views. Never drink because of this, and you must drink because of that, and there's so much of that kind of like noise around it. So it's lovely when people actually give like a really context, nuanced answer. So thank you so much for that. What's your ideal day from a longevity and health point of view?
It's really simple. It's getting a full night's sleep, waking up, spending time with the people that I love, and moving in nature. That's it. That if, you know, my ideal day is that. If I could have nothing else for the rest of my life, if I could just have that, that would be enough.
There's 100 people cancelling their Athletic Greens subscription as we speak.
Yeah, I think, again, you have to look at the major things in life. And again, you have to look at what's your priority. I mean, you know, I'm not training to be an Olympic 100-meter sprinter. If that was my goal in life, I would have to live my life very differently. If my goal was to be the CEO of a large multinational corporation, or to be the CEO of a small agile startup that is on a shoestring budget and is bootstrapping its way through kind of the production of its MVP, your life looks very different. But for me, I've learned to be incredibly intentional about how my day-to-day looks. To give me the freedom and flexibility to live the life that I want to do. And I've worked incredibly hard to craft that position. And I have sacrificed an incredible amount of things that probably I don't value as much, but historically I valued more to have that. Because again, I realized, what is the best representation of who I am? And how do I get to live that in the world? And you do it on purpose.
Talk to me about that. What are the major things people still overlook, and what are the kind of the minor stuff people are constantly obsessing over but isn't really important at all?
Supplements, probably number one, is the one that I think is majoring in the minor. They're so attractive because it's what I can do is I can pay money to do the work that I actually should do. And the reality is it's do the work. Don't ask for the hack. Don't ask for the shortcut. Don't ask for the quickest way to get from A to B. Sit down and do the work. I call it AICT, ass and chair time. You know, so it's like, the superpower is just sitting down in a focused mindset and doing the work. Or it's, you know, you want to increase your VO2 max or, you know, change your metabolic flexibility and fitness. Do the work every single day. Be purposeful about it and be intentional and do the work. And again, it's the eighth wonder of the world. You will reap the rewards of compound interest. And this is it. It's like, how do I blow up my Twitter account? How do I kind of like go from, you know, the fifth percentile to the 90th percentile in fitness? Do the work, find the things that work, and do it over and over and over and over again. And what you'll find is that the reason you will succeed is not because you did anything differently than anybody else. It's that you just did it over and over again, and everybody else just stopped.
I love that. You're really speaking my language. I have another kind of maxim I keep in my head, and it's like, are you going to take tiny wins today or tiny losses? You know, everything isn't cataclysmic. Like, we're all talking about these big things, and like, you know, like you said, everyone wants the one big thing that they can do, but really it's doing the tiny things again and again and again and again. We're approaching nearly 400 episodes of the pod, like, and it's only now we're starting to get some traction. They're kind of going, yeah, now you're starting to see the results, because it just takes so much longer. Talk to me then. Right, we're going to do the work right now. There's founders listening right now. What work should they be doing? Let's give them the 80% that they must be doing right now. And I'm asking you a very difficult question. I'm very conscious, because I'm asking you to give broad strokes to a very broad audience. But, you know, what's the 80% that people just must be doing?
What are you trying to optimize for?
Let's say longevity. The three golden pillars you're talking about there. We're looking for people to improve their health, increase their lifespan, and their soul span.
So, simple things. Number one, get 8 hours of sleep, or as close to it as makes no difference. Some people need 7 hours. Some people need closer to nine. The bottom line is you're going to need somewhere in and around there, and try and get that reliably 7 nights a week. That, you know, you don't get sleep right, everything else falls to pieces. So that should be your number one priority. There's people listening. It's like, I have a small baby. I have, you know, I do too. So sometimes it all goes to shit. But, you know, we're always just getting back in the horse and actually working toward that. So make that the highest order priority. Go to bed at exactly the same time and get up at exactly the same time, 7 days a week. You know, but what about the weekends? Yeah, those two. You know, if you want to have social jet lag, sure, knock yourself out. So, you know, but I can't stay out till 2 a.m. with my friends. Well, then don't do that, you know? And so the answer is again, what are you trying to optimize for? And is it important enough for you to do it? So sleep, number one. Number two, it has to be around exercise. If you are not doing exercise on a very regular basis, including both aerobic and resistance training, you are missing out on the biggest potential gains in terms of longevity and health span that are available to us. And there are no shortcuts. We know that people who are in the highest levels of VO2 max, in the top 2.5% of the average population, not Olympians, but the average population, if you are in that compared to the bottom 25%, you are 5 times less likely to die from anything over a 10-year time frame. And there is nothing in medicine that actually compares to that. Wow. Even if you're in the top 25% compared to the bottom 25%, you are 4 times less likely to die. That's 4 times, not 40%, but 4 times less likely to die from anything over a 10-year time frame. If longevity is a goal of yours, if it is it anywhere in your aspiration, if you are not exercising, you are not serious about longevity. It is the biggest lever that we can pull. And so therefore, it has to be part of your week.
Beautiful. Literally speaking my language. You're just reaffirming, like, and this is simple things, right? Sleep and move. Right, but consistency. I want to just ask you one quick question about the exact timings thing, because that's only something I've become aware of in the last kind of 18 months or so. Why is that so important to go to bed and get up at the same time?
It's to do with there's a basically a symphony of chemicals that are going up and down throughout the day in your body. Adenosine, melatonin, various different neurohormonal chemicals. And so they will have a cadence across your day, and you want to synchronize all of those. So basically you want adenosine rising throughout the day to build sleep pressure. You want to reach it. You want it to have it reaching its peak when you are going to sleep. You are going to eliminate external light sources so that you get a spike in melatonin. You will match that to your normal cortisol rise and fall that actually operates across kind of a twice daily peak. And as you line up all of these three things together, including the temperature of your environment, all of those should strike together, and you will naturally fall asleep without any issue. And then they will all go into reverse in the morning time, and you will naturally wake up in the morning. people constantly go on about how do I get up early in the morning and what strategy do I use? You know, the game is won before you go to bed, not when you're getting up. You do not need to set an alarm clock to get up. You need to set an alarm clock to go to bed. And it needs to go off the same time. That's when you use your alarm clock, because if you do it that way, you won't need one in the morning. And so that is why it is about orchestrating that symphony of chemicals and temperature so that they all fire at exactly the same time and then go into reverse at exactly the same time when you're going to sleep and you're waking.
I never really fully understood the impact of sleep until we had our daughter 16 months ago. It is dramatic. Like 20, 30, 40% performance drops when you're beleagueredly tired. It's phenomenal.
But here's the problem with that. Everyone is aware when they're utterly sleep deprived, how their performance drops off.
Yeah.
And so there are multiple studies that have shown this, that if you get people and you say, get them to sleep less than 5 hours per night, they will objectively say, they will objectively perform worse on various tasks, and they will subjectively say, listen, I feel terrible. If you get people to sleep more than 7 hours per night, they will say, I feel good, and they will objectively perform well. So no surprises there. But if you get someone to sleep between 5 and 7 hours, they will subjectively feel okay, but they will objectively perform the same as the ones who've slept less than 5 hours. So it's in that middle ground where you think that you're okay, but if you look at the objective metrics, you perform just as bad as the lower group.
That's really interesting, isn't it? It's so, you know, the subjective objective, like it's so hard sometimes when you're like, how do I feel? I don't know, because you can't really fully remember. It has to be extreme, right? You have to like, I feel amazing or I feel terrible. And it's just trust in the process, isn't it? And that's why I'm so keen to talk to you, because a lot of what you talk about, it's logic and it's compounding and you're breaking down the complex into the simple. And that's what every good founder should be able to do, is just to be able to be able to break the complex down to simple and do it over and over and over again. I just want to quickly talk about, you have a book coming out as well. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I eventually wrote a book, despite my best efforts and wishes. It's a challenging process to synthesize everything together. So it's basically, it's a simple explanation for patients in terms of understanding heart disease, defining the risk and how to reduce that risk. And so it's the compendium of information that I wish that I could hand to my patient and say, listen, if I had an opportunity to explain these things, so all the things that we're talking about here in terms of like, tell me about sleep, tell me about how that impacts my risk, and tell me about how to actually improve it. It's like, yeah, just these two chapters here on sleep. You know, tell me about nutrition. How do I approach that? Everything seems confusing. It's like right here, there's two pages on kind of how you kind of think about kind of nutrition and two pages tactically in terms of how you do it. So rather than me recycling these same spiels over and over again, and I would have to spend hours doing it, it'd say, listen, do you know what's a lot easier? We'll go through the process, but you know, read this book and you'll get everything that I need to know. So it's an easy and accessible kind of book for someone trying to understand heart disease and apply the principles that we've been talking about here. And hopefully it's done in a digestible way that basically anyone can consume, not just doctors.
Yeah, you have, I have to say, you have a beautiful writing style. Like your weekly newsletter is just, it's so accessible. Like, because for someone like me who's kind of engaged in their health, but still don't have mass medical knowledge, it's so, so accessible, because you've a lovely narrative quality to the writing. What is the book called and when does it come out?
So it's called Heart, an Owner's Guide, and it comes out in the UK and Ireland on May 2nd and in the US on May 7th.
Beautiful. Best of luck with that. That's exciting. Your Substack, can you just shout that out? Because what's the best way for people to join that? Because it's a really good read every week.
Yeah, just type in Dr. Paddy Barrett newsletter or Dr. Paddy Barrett Substack. You'll get it there and you can sign up. It's a free weekly newsletter that goes out and talks about everything we've been talking about here in terms of lifespan, health span, and soul span.
And Twitter is probably the best place to find you, is it?
Yeah, that's probably the place that I spend most of the time. It's @Paddy_Barrett. If you just type in Paddy Barrett, I generally post there once or twice a day and try and do that fairly consistently.
Right, we're going to do our rapid fire round. What's the one book everyone should read, apart from your own?
Well, I wouldn't start with my own. Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, is what I would recommend. That is a book I try and read once or twice every year. And if you want to put your life in perspective, that is the best way to do it. It is the story of a psychiatrist who spent 4 years in a Nazi concentration camp. And basically it is about crafting the narrative of your life insofar as that bad things will happen to you and the world will conspire against you, but you can always choose what to do next. And his famous quote from this is basically, when we cannot change our circumstances, we are forced to change ourselves. So we always face adversity, but we have to ask in terms of how will we change ourselves to deal with it.
Beautiful. What's something you'd learn the hard way?
Oh, how long do you have? Basically, if you don't do what you know that you should do, you will pay the price. And that price may be financial, it may be personal, it may be a relationship, it may be your health, but you will pay the price. And your body will tell you, either in your body or your mind, that you are off track. So beware.
I love that. There's a price to be paid always, so find the price. There's a great quote, find the price for success and be willing to pay it. It's the same in life, right? You have to, you know, there's a cost somewhere, whether it's time or money or effort or sacrifice, you know, there's a cost. And if it feels too good, it probably is. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
At the start of my career, pretty much everything. So I learned the hard way, friends, family, everything, until I, you know, realized that I was on the wrong track and I had to actually figure out what were the highest value priorities for me and realign those. So although I paid a price, I would think I was able to at least meaningfully recover many of them.
Some people never, the penny never drops on people. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
It's pretty simple. What I told you that I do in my ideal day, I'd get up in the morning, you know, I'd have coffee and spend time with my, my people that I love in terms of my family and my kids. I would read books and I would move in nature.
Okay, you're gonna, like, power compounding is gonna kick in for you. You're gonna, a 10 is gonna turn into a lot more very soon. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
Exercise. That may sound somewhat counterintuitive in terms of everything that I've said, but I actually came to exercise much later in my life. And that was largely a function of not having the time to actually do it. So it was only when I was able to design my life in such a way that I gave myself the time that I was able to devote enough energy into exercising. So yeah, you know, through my teenage years, you know, I played sports and things like that, but I never really, I think, used exercise in the way that I should have. And so it was only later in life that I really took it seriously.
Hmm. If you left medicine in the morning, start a company, what would it be?
I would not start a company. The thoughts of having multiple employees makes me nauseous.
That's so funny. For a man who deals with stress and high pressure situations every day, that's hilarious. Okay, that's fair enough. What do you believe that other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
We're here for a super short time. And I think people think that they realize that, but it's only when you've seen it up close and you've seen it repeatedly that you really realize the brevity of the time that we have here. You know, I think we see this endless stream of commentary about criticism of the world in terms of this is wrong and that's wrong and, you know, we're destroying the planet. You know, you should look outside and just marvel at the absolute wonder that we're here at all, that we get to go outside, that things work, that people pay their taxes and people drive on the correct side of the road. It's an absolute miracle. And as Louis C.K., who's certainly kind of lost some of his popularity, would say, it's like everything's amazing, but nobody's happy. And people get really pissed off when the Wi-Fi and the airplane breaks. It's like you're in a tube in the sky doing 500 miles an hour and someone serving you coffee. You should be screaming with absolute marvel and delight, not giving out about the Wi-Fi.
So funny you say that. I did this like weird experiment on Monday. I took the train down to Rosslare just to work. I was like, right, I'm going to get the train to Rosslare to work, not even going to get off, and then I'm going to get the train all the way back just to work, just to deep work. And I was like, that was amazing. And I put up a story going, that was absolutely class, 4 hours deep concentration. First few comments I got, yeah, but the Wi-Fi is shite. I'm like, what's wrong with you? Like, context is everything. Like, look inside. Like, as you say, like, everything is just, like, the fact that we're even here at all is just wild. Like, that blows my mind. I have a rule, never complain about something unless you're going to do something about it. And that, when you just think about things like life like that, things get a lot better. What's one thing you spend money on that brings you a lot of happiness or joy?
It's money is not something that typically the spending of it brings me happiness and joy. I think, as I've said multiple times before, spending it's the free things in life that bring me the greatest amount of money, greatest amount of joy. I am happiest with people I love, in a forest, that costs sweet F all.
We're going to buy a forest for that 10 million. I'm going to help you spend that money. We're going to buy a forest. What's your final piece of advice to everyone listening that they could take away to kind of like improve their kind of overall health span, lifespan, soul span?
Life is short. Act accordingly.
Paddy, that was beautiful. Thank you so much. We've kind of covered where people can learn more about you, but is there anywhere else you'd like to direct them?
No. Best place. Head over to Twitter. You'll see all the kind of the chaos there.
Dr. Paddy Barrett, thank you. That was an absolute pleasure.